Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Grace Dillon. I'm editor at ExchangeWire. And joining me this week is our very special guest is Paul Casamias, who's managing partner at Performix. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hi, really well, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure. And joining me as well on the other side of the ExchangeWire office is head of content at ExchangeWire, Lindsay Roundtree. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm good. How are you, Grace?
I'm very well, thank you.
First time hosting.
Yeah, got the meeting room all to myself, feeling very important.
Yeah, normally taken over by Kieran, so you're very fortunate to actually get a look in the meeting room.
Yeah, I'll enjoy it while it lasts.
Definitely. Make the most of it.
Will do. Okay, so we dive straight into our first story. TikTok are currently trialling an e-commerce feature in Europe, which many commentators are saying could put them in tighter competition with Facebook, who recently launched their own discovery commerce feature in Europe. If successful, the launch could give TikTok an IPO valuation of $250 billion, with the company heading to go public later on this year. So a very significant story. Paul, what do you think of TikTok's move into e-commerce, especially within Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite unsurprising, really, given that they're kind of a Chinese-owned company. And if you think about the Chinese market, they're probably more advanced in social commerce than UK and Europe. And, you know, as an example, in 2016, they launched what we're talking about now, which is shoppertainment channels. So, you know, in-app QVC type forum with influencers and groups talking about brands. And, you know, they've got a really unique proposition in terms of their creator funds, where they get, you know, they fund creators to come on the platform and talk about engaging kind of content, but also make it really easy for influencers and potential advertisers or brands to connect together. So it's unsurprising. And I think, you know, they're going to use a lot of the experience they have in China, where it's more kind of that in-app ecosystem is far more developed than the UK and Europe. So I think they're primed to do really well kind of in the UK and Europe. They've got the foundation there. Obviously, Europe's a completely different beast, but I think the Western world in this instance can learn a lot from kind of the existing setup. And I think just this morning, if I'm not mistaken, the CEO of ByteDance stepped down, which shows you, you know, how kind of not aggressive they are in the way they operate, but they're not scared to change leadership. They're not scared to change direction in which they operate in. And just kind of taking a step back, 2 years ago, when I first heard of TikTok through one of my colleagues, Oscar, I was kind of taking the mick out of him. Like, this isn't going to be a thing. This is going to be like Tumblr. It's going to completely like fall off the radar. And, you know, 2 years later, it's a massive threat to Facebook. And I think under no illusions, they're going after kind of that North Star Facebook. I don't think they're thinking small. When they first came into our office, I was kind of didn't really know what to make of the proposition, because it wasn't a very polished deck. It was very kind of startup in nature. The sales kind of reps that came across were quite young, which was great, but they were really hungry to sort of develop and sell the proposition. And, you know, I think what they're not scared to do is put things out in market really quickly. So they don't mind driving the car whilst building the engine, whereas a Facebook want to get everything polished. They're a bit more mature in the way that they are kind of more of an established brand and an established player in the market. But I think, yeah, I think they've got the foundations to really kind of make successful strides in this space.
Yeah, lots of really interesting points that you've touched on. Lindsay, what do you think about, well, TikTok's venture into e-commerce within the European space, especially in comparison to Douyin in Asia, where e-commerce and in-app shopping is far bigger than it is over here?
Yeah, I think what's happening in Asia with e-commerce shopping and all the examples Paul just mentioned kind of put put TikTok in a really interesting place. They announced in the US last year about adding e-commerce formats into TikTok that were being trialed by some advertisers. And I think that, you know, as Paul mentioned, what ByteDance are really good. I didn't know that about the CEO stepping down. I see stepping down, handing over to college roommate. Interesting.
Yeah.
So that's fascinating. You're absolutely right. Like, and the changes they are willing to make literally on a dime, as well as build, as you say, build the company while they're still like drive the car whilst they're still building the engine, versus US companies that tend to be much slower and tend to need to take stock of things and plan things and normally acquire things to actually get the tech they want. Chinese tech companies are much more willing to go, right, let's just do it, see what happens. And they've got the benefit of having such scale in China that helps them deliver these things more quickly. Like their daily active users in China, 600 million for Douyin, which is half the population are actively using Douyin daily. So they've got so much opportunity to learn from how to do social commerce in Asia and bring that over to Europe. But at the same time, they've got to remember that Europe is completely, completely different. And they will need to think about how we buy, how we consume, how we use social media versus how we then go on to purchase. Obviously, there are social opportunities within the likes of Instagram, which prove how it works and prove there's an appetite for it. And what will be interesting to see will be the kinds of formats that TikTok bring into play here. What they're doing in Douyin, for example, is that when a video is showing, you have a small link that shows you can buy it. When the first loop of that video is ended, you then the banner expands to kind of a bigger, almost sort of like half-size product page. So if you wanted to view it again, then you've got a better idea of the product. And then it's all about keeping it within the TikTok platform will be the important thing to make sure that they can keep their users inside, keep them sticky, and not send them off somewhere else so they won't then return. And that's what Instagram is doing. But I think as Paul was saying, I haven't heard the word shoppertainment before. What a word. Yeah, that's a mouthful and a half. The shoppertainment aspect, the kind of the QVC aspect, the live streaming shopping, again, absolutely massive in Asia. And it's second nature to them to buy products in that way, to watch somebody displaying the latest skirt and then going clicking, yeah, I want that, I'm going to buy it. That I think the older generations that are used to kind of the TV commerce aspect will probably couldn't imagine that being done on social media. And it's the younger viewers, the younger consumers, Generation Z probably are going to be well up for trying those kinds of things. And it'll be, again, second nature to them to consume in that way. And it just shows how the lines of content and commerce are really blurring, that you won't be able to kind of just pick them apart. But I think that, and Paul, you saying about kind of what it was like when TikTok first launched in the market and you had kind of all these young, hungry salespeople coming to you to with propositions and it felt very startup-y. I think that, I feel that there are going to be advertisers out there, the more sophisticated ones are still not going to feel that they're ready to put their faith in TikTok yet, because it is still quite nascent and they are still doing things kind of on the fly. But the integration they're doing with Shopify, where you can, if you're a Shopify client, you can run advertising campaigns through TikTok via the Shopify platform, are very, very interesting. And things like that will massively, massively help the likes of TikTok see that scale. But I think that the larger, more sophisticated advertisers will err on the side of caution in the beginning. But for SMEs and for like DTC brands, like, you know, TikTok is a great source of people that are selling like their homewares and things like jewelry and what's the craze, like everyone's making resin coasters on TikTok. All those kind of people, if they are able to sell their products directly within the TikTok platform, they're going to take massive advantage. And much like the likes of Google and Facebook, it will be the SMEs with a long tail that really drive the revenue. It won't be the bigger advertisers that are driving the revenue. It'll be them. And that's where TikTok, I think, will really win.
So, I mean, thinking about Douyin and e-commerce and big tech in Asia, how do you think TikTok will fare considering the amount of competition that there is already in China with Alibaba and Tencent, obviously being, Tencent's offering was launched, I think, in 2020, so more recently, but Alibaba's Taobao being around since 2016, there is certainly more entrenched competition. So how do you think that will, do you think that's inspired TikTok's move towards Europe and exploring different markets? But also, how do you think they'll fare there in comparison, considering the competition and also considering sort of the Chinese government's tougher stance towards big tech? Quite a lot in that question, but whatever you can unpick.
Yeah, no, it's that's a big question. I think, you know, where there's money on the table, they'll go after it. basically. And they've seen that the Europe is an opportunity for that. It's a multi-billion pound kind of commerce is a multi-billion pound kind of area for them. In China, it's still a trillion dollar kind of pound area. So, or dollar area. So I think, you know, wherever there's opportunity, they'll go after it. I think in the middle of the pandemic, they were everywhere on LinkedIn. They were the fastest growing probably company in the UK or Europe. I could only see job postings for TikTok roles. So they didn't let anything stop them, right? They were just going after kind of building their proposition. And strategically, they've made really smart hires as well. So they've gone after kind of the bigwigs of YouTube and other similar platforms and brought those people in to accelerate their proposition. I think there is such thing as almost a last mover advantage as well. So they're kind of, you've heard of first mover advantage, but they're quite late to the social ecosystem within Europe. But what they've been able to do is really learn from a lot of the other social platforms. So they know that, you know, Snapchat and their filters are really popular, and that AR kind of driven environment is one which can translate to commerce quite quickly. So they brought out their brand effects kind of proposition quite quickly. But I think where they have a really unique selling point and, you know, where they're being really, really smart is this creator fund. They put £1 billion into giving back to creators and influencers, particularly in Europe. And that is taking traction and making really good headway. So the platform becomes almost self-fulfilling in a sense, because TikTok are giving this money to creators to create content and engage with brands. The types of content on the platform are becoming more engaging because you're working with professionals. Therefore, lots more people are using the platform. The stickiness of the platform, the dwell time is a lot more kind of extensive. Therefore, advertisers want to be on that platform and start investing in the advertising kind of side of things. So it's all sort of funding itself and fulfilling itself. And I think that, you know, in the Western world, that's certainly taking off and they see that there's huge opportunity. China is probably going to be a bit more difficult to crack beyond what they're doing. So they're looking outside of that. And the US, obviously, there's been kind of socio-political kind of restrictions with Trump, et cetera. But maybe that will change with Biden. There were rumors about Microsoft and Oracle kind of acquiring parts of their business or leading in the US. So we'll just see how that sort of plays out over time, I think.
Are your advertisers, how are your clients engaging with TikTok? Are they interested in advertising on them? Are they doing much stuff with them?
Yeah, I think to your point, Lindsay, like some of the bigger kind of tier one global brands, they're certainly advertising with them. We're using the self-serve platform. There are, you know, there's a bit more resistance to go after the alpha type things that haven't been launched yet. You know, they're taking a bit of a step back to your point and saying, you know, we probably don't need to be there. I think it's definitely more geared towards the SMEs of this world. And, you know, I think there's probably a question of business risk. You know, do we want to go down that route knowing there's a bit of risk in terms of brand safety or the features not fully developed yet? So I certainly think there's an element of truth in what you're saying in terms of some of the bigger players. But we are seeing sort of that said, we're seeing 200-300% growth year on year in the platform.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's definitely taking off. And, you know, there's not a misconception or misnomer, but I think TikTok is changing as a platform as well in the UK and Europe. Like everyone thinks it's just a Gen Z platform, which predominantly is. I mean, if you go out to, you know, in the street, you can hear kids going, oh, I'm recording a TikTok or whatever it might be. But it feels like the platform is also aging up now. So if you looked at some of their kind of broader media advertising on TV, you know, don't make ads, make TikToks. That was geared towards sort of a bit of an older kind of generation, age category, I should say. And I think, you know, the recent stats are showing that the platform is actually aging up as well. So it's not just this Gen Z kind of area. That's their core base, but they're also going into the kind of 34 to 44 year olds kind of bracket. And I think that's a huge sort of growth opportunity for them as well.
I mean, I was going to ask whether you thought now was the right time to sort of go harder on e-commerce, considering the world's starting to open up a bit and, you know, physical retail is coming back. But from the sounds of it, it does, you know, it sounds like the best time for it. But what impact do you think sort of post-lockdown could have on their growth or on e-commerce generally?
I think, I mean, it's even pre-pandemic, it was the most downloaded app globally, I think, in the world. So I don't see it having a major shift. I think people that have got used to buying in different ways will continue to do that. I think there will be a bit of a hybrid. You know, how do we make sure that, you know, we're linking our physical stores with online kind of activity? I think some of the bigger brands will go, okay, well, you know, these app ecosystems are becoming really, really powerful now. Who actually owns the user experience? So if I'm a big global brand, who owns that customer? If the customer is staying within an ecosystem, who owns that user experience from beginning to end? And I think that's a big question. And I think that might be something that will act as almost a bit of a barrier in terms of how they scale the platform further.
That's a really interesting point, actually, because I think that there's unknown around social anyway. I feel like in terms of it can be daunting for many brands to kind of venture into it and not know how to engage it on that kind of platform. And, you know, we've always talked about brands that try to repurpose TV. TV content for search, for video, for YouTube, whatever else, and trying to do that same thing for social will just crash and burn. And how do they engage those users, understand what they're doing? We chat about that with gaming, right? We say that that brands believe gaming is a gamer is a certain type of person, like some prepubescent person in their mum's basement, but there's so much more to gaming than that. And it feels like social's the same. Like a lot of brands are looking at social and thinking it's just the young kids that are using it. But Paul, as you said, the demographic of TikTok is changing. The demographic of Instagram and Facebook has already gone through this transition to the point where Facebook is now a much older demographic than it used to be. Like, I think that there needs to be who owns the entire user journey is a very interesting question that brands are probably trying to get their heads around. There must be a big education piece required from in your role then in that case.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we've got to a point where brands that we work with don't see social as Facebook.
That's an amazing transition.
Right? That's
finally made it.
I mean, going back a couple of years, you know, social was Facebook. Now it's so more complex than that. And actually you're trying to understand, you know, being more strategic and like what is actually the role of each of these platforms. You know, each of the platforms themselves also, they're not just they allow you to sort of tactically and strategically take a user from an awareness stage right the way through to conversion, right? That's what's happening now within the TikTok ecosystem. So I wonder if we're going to move to a world with some of our clients where we're talking about, you know, obviously back in the day, we used to talk about channels and then we're talking, you know, it's not about channels, it's about the audience and being audience agnostic and channel agnostic, I should say. Are we going to move to a world of, you know, it's going to be a platform-based world? So, you know, these closed ecosystems are becoming so big that is it going to be like platform-based Facebook and Instagram activity, TikTok, Google, you know, Amazon, they're their own sort of ecosystems. And I think that's going to require a bit of a pivot from agencies and advertisers to think about the market slightly differently.
So, I mean, just thinking about Facebook and how they fit in, what do you think they can effectively do, if anything, or what sort of advantage do they have that could give them an edge over TikTok, at least in the short term, if any? I mean, I suppose thinking about their appeal and the fact that they've already aged up and, you know, are more well established, and I suppose there's more insight into how to navigate their platform and how to arrange campaigns within it. Do you think that could serve to, you know, benefit them, or what else could they possibly do to sort of stave off TikTok?
Yeah, I think for me, and Lindsay, you probably have a perspective on it as well, but I think it's the maturity aspect of the platform, right? They are more than a social kind of engine now, right? A social platform. They have made really interesting hires, like Nick Clegg still works for Facebook, right? I mean, it's so much more than a social platform nowadays. And the work they're doing in terms of, you know, brand safety and making sure the platform is fit for purpose and a force for good and all of this type of stuff shows that it's become like a really mature kind of platform. I think TikTok are a little way off that and they're still quite cutting edge. And, you know, I'm sure the guys still work out of a WeWork, right? Somewhere in central London. So I think it's just different. It's slightly more mature. I think they're going to focus on, you know, the Facebook Watch proposition. That's a massive growth area for them. And they'll probably go into that kind of area. I think they're going to put a lot of focus behind that kind of area.
Yeah, I think culturally, if you speak to some of the earlier employees of TikTok when they worked in the London office, they very much felt like they were working for a Chinese company, and it was being managed like a Chinese company. But unfortunately, it was TikTok in London. It can't be treated like a Chinese company. It has to be culturally to kind of get the message across and get the feel across of what TikTok is and what it represents in the UK and across Europe. The culture internally needs to represent that, and it didn't. And apparently, it was quite challenging to work there. And it was, you know, very, very different kind of, well, obviously culture, because it's two worlds colliding, really. And that, I think, is now going through a transition itself. And just that transition happening from a business perspective will mean that you'll see that transition happening when you see kind of how TikTok evolves as a platform for consumers, for creators, and for advertisers too.
Very, very interesting stuff. And I mean, I'm sure this is going to be something we will keep tabs on over the coming weeks, especially with the CEO stepping down. Yeah, great chat there. So moving on to our second story. So Airbnb have cut their marketing spend by over 50% over the past year, and by a further 45% in Q1 of 2021 alone. The reduction came mainly from a decrease in performance marketing spend and a slight increase in brand marketing spend, with the company running its biggest brand marketing campaign in 5 years during the quarter. So the CFO and CEO of Airbnb have both said that they planned to move away from performance marketing spend prior to the pandemic, but the health crisis sped up their decision. And despite spending nothing on performance marketing, they saw revenues increase 5%, traffic increase 95%, and 90% of that traffic coming from unpaid or direct sources. And both have vowed not to go back to spending anywhere near as much on performance marketing, but also promising to improve marketing efficiency after going public late last year. Paul, come to you first. So what do you think this decision says about performance marketing generally? I mean, is it a surprising move by Airbnb, or is it a fairly understandable one? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say surprising. I mean, how many Airbnbs are there out in the market, right? They are synonymous with the sort of short-term holiday let type experience, right? They own the category. They are the category. Therefore, why do you need to spend so much in performance marketing? Everyone knows who you are. You know, there aren't too many businesses out there, is my point, right? In that position. So it really depends on, you know, the brand's proposition, where they are in terms of, you know, how dominant they are in the market, how much, you know, how much do they actually need to advertise to harvest that demand? If we think about kind of enterprise rent-a-car in the US, similar type of business, there's more searches for a kind of enterprise rent-a-car than there is for car hire, right? They are the category. And my point really is there aren't too many businesses like that out there. So, you know, I don't see performance marketing budgets being slashed sort of drastically. I do see this as a sort of play on the fact that they've become public as well. They probably want to show they're a lean and efficient company. That makes sense. Were they over-investing in performance? Probably. But what's interesting about Airbnb specifically is what they're actually offering is almost like it's an aggregator type model. And that's very commoditized in nature, right? It's a money supermarket. It's a compare the market. It's a booking.com to the extreme. That booking.com doesn't strike to me like that's a big brand play, right? That is a booking engine. It fulfills a need. I need to book a holiday, car hire, whatever it might be, right? So I think what's interesting is those types of businesses are now have built a business off the back of good performance-based activity. So they've built it from the bottom up. And they're at a point now where they're going, we actually need to mature as a brand and start to tell us more complex stories around, you know, Airbnb. So they need to invest in more of kind of the middle of funnel and top of funnel. Whereas kind of traditional advertising from a big sort of brand play is the other way around. It's almost reversing the model. So if I'm Samsung, as an example, I'm a big brand advertiser, I'm going out with big brand messaging, I now need to pivot to D2C, right? I now need to think about my own store, my own properties. And I think that's what's really interesting about it. I think it's just flipping the model. So more money's going into commerce for big brand advertisers because they're quite, well, they haven't realized that potential sort of historically, whereas advertisers that have had to build from the bottom up are probably thinking about the reverse. Am I spending too much in performance marketing? And should I think about what that big brand complex story is, right? How do I start to engage users for the long term and not the short term? That's kind of my view on that one.
And Lindsay, what do you think of the move? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think for me, it's an interesting one. as Paul says, Airbnb, I mean, good for Airbnb, basically, if that's what they've established, then fantastic news. They are the category, so they can afford to do that. They have spent billions, probably, on branding over a number of years to the point where they are a brand, they are a category. They, you know, it, other companies had to almost go into emergency mode in the past year because there was no travel, people couldn't go anywhere. But Airbnb actually benefited from it because they had staycations. So even where there were lockdowns in certain countries, you were still able to go and travel places. Airbnb still was still reaping the benefits from that. And they even branched out into being able to do where Airbnb have their experiences section. They even did virtual experiences. So I know a friend who actually got a magician in India to do a kind of a team bonding thing for them. Wow. And it was apparently brilliant and hilarious and so random. And I had no idea Airbnb even did that, but they were innovating throughout the pandemic as well. So, you know, they've got to a stage where their brand is so mature now that they probably have reached scale when it comes to being a from the property side of things. They're able to go and look into new areas. They might even go into car hire. So actually people renting out their own cars to people when they're not in use, that could be the next thing. So for them as a category, they can kind of do what the hell they like. But my concern, and Paul, you remember this years ago when eBay said, we've done some research and decided to actually, there is no point in us bidding on our own brand terms on paid search because everyone knows eBay anyway. So we're not going to bother. And the people that managed eBay were like, well, crap, that's us screwed because we've now, that's tons of budget they were paying us as an agency to manage their brand terms. And it helped us be able to attribute and prove the value of generic search and everything else. So kind of all these different challenges. But what happened was tons of clients, both large and small, all went to their agencies and went, okay, eBay have said that there's no point bidding on brand terms. We don't want to do it anymore. And it became a big problem. And many agencies, I was doing it with my clients. Paul was, I think, doing it as well, saying, no, that's eBay. eBay are a category of the in their own world. Like they can afford to do that. People are only ever really searching eBay. They're not searching for something similar to eBay. So you are in a very competitive market. You're a car insurer. You definitely need to build your own brand terms, because if you don't, somebody else will. And my concern when this kind of this anecdotal story comes out about Airbnb doing this is that other brands will go, well, if they've decided they need to invest in performance marketing, then maybe we don't either. And it's like, well, you probably do, because you're probably in a very competitive category. And if you don't, you will lose out, and you haven't got the brand to be able to back that up. But then the interesting thing about this as well is over the past few years, there's been more talk about how can branding and performance work better together, and where do the lines blur? And when you're talking about branding and investing tons in TV or in out of home, whatever else, how can you also bring an element of measurability to that? Not to the point where it's one-to-one advertising, but the point where you actually do understand that when you are investing X amount in a TV campaign, that you are actually seeing the uptick come from that through direct traffic. And that's, I think, what's going to be the interesting thing. Are they looking at it from that perspective? Are they just going, sod it, we're going to put 10 million on this campaign, and then, you know, we might well see some more traffic. Fantastic. We might not, but we don't really know. I imagine they're not. I imagine there will be some element of performance in the branding they're doing as well.
We've sort of acknowledged that Airbnb's decision is quite anomalous. It's not really something that most brands can afford to do or really should do. So with that in mind, how relevant and how important do you think performance marketing is generally?
Yeah, I think performance marketing will always be important. It will always be really kind of a key part of the brand's arsenal, really. The question is, how much are you investing in performance marketing versus brand? Getting that kind of the right blend between brand and performance, and this messy middle area called mid-funnel, right, where it gets really complex. I think that's really the question. I think, you know, performance marketing to a finance director is like crack cocaine. It's like really addictive, because I know where my money's going and it's going in a really effective place and I want more of that. But by just focusing on more of that, it doesn't mean that you're going to get incremental sort of customers for the long term. So you need to think about, yes, I'm harvesting demand, I'm building up my customer database, I'm going to get to a point where I've really maximized that customer database and I understand the lifetime value of my customers and I'm re-messaging them and engaging them at the right times. But what about the long term? Who's filling up that kind of pipeline for the future? And I think that's where the interesting part comes in. And that's where measurement is a major piece. And it's difficult for brands to navigate that internally, because they ultimately, a lot of the time, the CFO holds the budget, right? So you need to prove to the CFO that this top of funnel stuff is actually working. And it's far more complex to build a sort of measurement framework around, you know, reach and middle of funnel, you know, building familiarity. How do you actually measure that? Do you work with GWI? Do you put out research funnel, you know, research surveys? How are you actually thinking about those more sort of complex engagements with customers, more qualitative engagements? So I think that's, I think it's here to stay. It's just about getting the right balance. And every brand is different, ultimately.
Do you think branding will become more important to big brands that go, well, it's easy now that Google is deprecating the third-party cookie and that makes tracking more challenging, now that we're seeing the same happen on in the app environment as well, you know, the Airbnb could have a play here as well with iOS 14 and ATT. Are they thinking, well, because we can't track the same way, it's going to become so complicated to do it in the future. Actually, we know that branding works for us and we can measure it in other ways. Is that going to become a concern? Are people going to go into branding more because of that? Or is performance still going to be a very important part? And actually, does the measurability part aspect of that not really matter? Because we've still got the ability to attribute, the ability to do econometric modeling. And as you say, kind of there are other paths to be able to work that out anyway.
Yeah, I think the industry will work through this one, right? Like we have in the past. And I think, you know, there'll be probably a bit more focus on market mix modeling. Modeling will take more emphasis over attribution, probably. So it'll just be a shift in the way that we operate. We'll dial up certain elements of data science to show, you know, to measure and understand consumers in the right way. So I don't see it being that different, to be honest. I think first party data, we've spoken about first party data for how long? Like 4 or 5 years. We know that's important. We know that's gold. We've been telling brands, think about your first party data and how you communicate and bring your CRM closer to your media activity. So I think all this is doing is accelerating a lot of what we've spoken about. I remember sort of 10 years ago, we were talking about the year of the mobile, probably longer. Right. And everyone's it's the year of the mobile.
That lasted for 10 years as well. Yeah.
It feels like a similar kind of thing. We're talking to brands about, you know, their data, their properties. Think about your first party customers, profile, segment, understand them, talk to them in engaging ways. Think about the holistic user experience. I think all of those things are still relevant. And, the brands that do that the best will reap the rewards, I think.
And that's where brands like you mentioned Samsung as a brand earlier. That's where brands like Samsung need to really kind of get into those that have traditionally not been concerned about their own first party data and worked with third party retailers are now going to have to look at that very differently, right?
Yeah. I mean, and they have credit to the team there. They're kind of seen as market leaders in that space. And we were lucky enough to win the CRM business recently. We're bringing . So goes into a guy called Mike Drury there, who I think you might know, Lindsay, from previous world, but. We've brought CRM a lot closer to media activation and looking at that holistic piece from, you know, looking at the customer database. We know so much about the customers, useful information to allow us to message them in the right ways across platforms, whether they're in market for a new phone, whether they're dormant, without giving away too much of the approach and the strategy. But, you know, they're really sophisticated in that space and they've come along that journey really quickly is the point. And I think advertisers can do it, but, you know, those that delay or don't really have their house in order are going to really suffer with the lack of targeting and probably have to have a bit of a rethink in terms of, you know, it might be easier to your point to go, okay, I'm going to put more money in contextual advertising or brand media, but is that going to have an overall benefit for them? That's the big question.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I'll move us along to our final story. So this one is about Merkle's Q1 2021 digital marketing report focusing on US ad spend, which found that ad spend rose across the US generally. So Google experienced growth among their paid search, that was up 20%, while click declines also decreased, so another positive result for them. Amazon saw success with their sponsored brands ad format, which had higher clicks and higher growth, as well as a very impressive rise in impressions, which were up 113%. Their sponsored products format also performed fairly well and actually achieved higher sales out of all their formats, so that was up 36%. Social platforms, meanwhile, were a bit of a mixed bag. So Facebook's impressions were up slightly, but they were hampered by competition and higher CPMs. Whereas for Instagram, ad spend grew 58% year over year. Meanwhile, LinkedIn and Pinterest also had success, while Twitter and Snapchat saw ad spend decrease. And finally, CTV and audio racked up the most investment for omnichannel brands. So they had a very successful first quarter as well. So Lindsay, I'll come to you first for this one. Are you surprised by any of the findings in Merkle's report, or do they sort of align with a lot of the other bits of news you've seen or reports you've read up?
I think it's yes and no. It's tough to really, some of the stats are January year on year, and some of them are Q1. And if we think, you know, while it feels like we've been in the pandemic for the past 15 years, actually in January last year, things were still relatively normal. In the US, definitely they were relatively normal. Like things hadn't shut down for a few months until a few months later. So I am surprised in some regard to see such a jump, like 33%. It's a massive stat year on year for 1 month alone. But at the same time, in the UK, it was certainly very miserable in January because we were all locked down. I know things were opening up more in the US by this point. But it's amazing to see that there's been such a positive rebound. I think generally it shows there's such positivity for ad spend. Like it counteracts the story about Airbnb like slashing budget on performance. And you might read that and panic and go, okay, advertisers are going to slash their marketing budgets. The reports like this kind of prove that's not the case. The budgets will go somewhere else, and they'll be that there's definitely growth opportunities to be had. I think what interests me about this report is the way it's written. Like it's written in the way that Google benefited from increased clicks and Facebook lost out on impressions because of higher CPMs. It's like, oh yay for Google, they've got even more bloody revenue. Fantastic. And Amazon's shoppable ad formats have meant that Amazon are getting even more clicks and more sales through. Fantastic. Amazon didn't need more money, but whatever else. But I think the reason that, you know, it's fascinating to see Amazon doing so well. I think obviously retail has seen a massive uptick. You will see as retailers do more advertising, they will also have to feel the need to be present on Amazon. It's better the devil you know for many advertisers. They don't enjoy doing it, but they feel they have to. Also, with Amazon launching new ad formats, that helps visibility. It helps Amazon get more revenue as well. When you've got more ad formats, like, you know, they'll be able to get more money from that. And that's probably why they are seeing sales up massively. I think for me, one of the most interesting things about the report was what you mentioned at the end, Grace, which is the uptick in CTV and audio. It's the growth in emerging channels. I think there was a stat saying that a third of advertiser budgets that invest in display and social was actually going on emerging channels like video and audio. Emerging, I'm not sure. Been around for a while, but whatever. But I mean, certainly digital audio is more emerging than video. But if we're looking at video from CTV perspective, it's very interesting. But I like the fact that the advertisers are looking into new areas and not just relying on tried and tested methods and tried and tested channels, and trying out new ways to get their audience, particularly as consumption has changed so much in the past 12 months, that the year-on-year trends on that will be significant, because there'll be 9 months of learnings there about how consumers have been using video, using consuming TV, consuming streaming channels, consuming audio versus Q1 last year, which looked very, very different. So that for me is the interesting stuff.
Very good. And Paul, how do these results sort of compare to what you've seen or what you've read up?
Yeah, pretty similar, actually. They're quite unsurprising. I think, you know, Lindsay's right in the sense that, you know, you've got to look at it sort of market by market. You know, all the markets are behaving differently, different points of lockdown. You know, that does drive different sort of patterns in video consumption, or, you know, what people do with their time at home. But what we've generally seen is kind of, if we were to put clients in three different buckets, it would be kind of, it's for some clients to massively accelerate what they're doing. So a lot of the FMCG type brands that were relying on a physical presence or selling through supermarkets or whatever it might be, they've accelerated their D2C propositions quite quickly. And they've sort of like got sites up or apps out there really, really quickly.
It's been amazing, isn't it? Yeah. In some cases, yeah.
Absolutely.
Incredible to watch that.
I think, like, you know, it's been one of the worst years that we've had in terms of just general stuff, right? It's been horrible. But in terms of being someone in, you know, working in the media industry, it's been one of the most interesting. I think, you know, watching businesses pivot around that has really, you know, kept me really interested in the work that we're doing for clients. If I think about Lidl as a business, they launched the Lidl Plus app, right? They don't have, you can't buy online for with Lidl, right? You have to go to the physical stores. But what they've been able to do is launch the app, start to build up their first party data, understand customers, give them a value exchange and sort of experience in store and tie that online, offline kind of journey together. So those types of brands have really accelerated in the space in terms of launching D2C, their D2C propositions. I think the ones that have suffered are kind of obviously the travel and hospitality verticals. And what's been interesting about those kind of businesses is, yes, they've pulled back on their paid search campaigns and their media activity, like that's a given. But what is really interesting is they've pivoted to different areas of their business. So B2B is an example. So one of the big transport kind of ferry companies that we work with has moved from B2C into freight. So they're using all of that kind of shipping and all of their kind of assets to diversify the way in which they're making revenue streams. And it's similar for other travel providers. So I think that's been really interesting because that's allowed us to kind of supercharge LinkedIn efforts or B2B channels, right? And then the third kind of bucket of customers are the ones that are high-fiving, right? So the entertainment type streaming and the entertainment type clients that we have that have hit kind of their yearly targets in 8 weeks. And then the conversation pivots to like, okay, we've got all of these great clients and new customers now. What do we know about them? How do we pivot to when things open up? How do we pivot to retention and really make sure that we're maximizing those customers and not forgetting about the long term? Because when things are going really well, you can quite easily not innovate because things are going so well. Everything's going well. Why would we do anything different, right? Everyone's high-fiving. So I think that's what's been really interesting for me is looking at each of the verticals, each of the different clients, understanding, you know, how we can drive value and be a good partner for them.
Very interesting. I read up another report by Campaign before coming on the podcast that said that they expect ad spend to accelerate into 2021, and they think that social will be sort of at the forefront of that recovery. So is it with that in mind, how does that sort of relate to the report, Merkel's report, that, you know, social did have some success? So Facebook and Instagram and Pinterest, LinkedIn had some success, whereas Twitter and Snapchat sort of faltered slightly. And do you agree that, you know, social could well be at the forefront of sort of recovery post-pandemic?
Yeah, I think so. From my perspective, we've seen all the social channels grow. Basically, so all that out of home money probably went into social, right? Like it had to go somewhere. Social is so much more than just Facebook now, right? It's an immersive experience. It's an extension of your, well, it's an extension of your kind of broad reach campaigns, your TV campaigns in some instances. Yes, nuanced. It's driving to commerce. It's allowing for influencers to have a share of the pie. You know, it's so much more complex and sophisticated than what it was a few years ago. So it's no surprise to me that, you know, there's been an acceleration in investment in those commerce platforms. There's more platforms out there. They're exciting. That's where the younger generation hang out a lot of the time. I think it's no surprise to me. We've seen sort of 20, 30% growth across the brands in social.
That's significant.
Yeah, it's massive, yeah. Massive. Yeah, I mean, it's varied by platform. Some of the platforms have started from a lower base, but even Pinterest, you're talking about in the, you know, 100% increase. All of the social platforms have really, really accelerated in terms of investment. So I see that continuing, to be honest.
Is this driven by brands looking for new, exciting opportunities? They're looking for innovative ways to get in front of their audience?
Yeah, I think so. There's an element of that. So I think,
or is it cheaper?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. If you think about, like, let's take TikTok as a platform, right? It allows brands to do so many different things. It allows you to work with, it brings, I think you touched on the point earlier, but it brings content, creative, commerce closer together in one ecosystem. That's really interesting. That's really exciting. And everyone wins in that kind of environment. The influencers get paid out on an affiliate model. You're producing good content for your, like, innovative content that resonates with the younger generation, which are going to be your future customers. You know, I think it allows you to reach the right audiences with the right messages and be creative with it. And I think that's what's driving, you know, people are at home looking at the same four walls. They want to be inspired, right? And I think that's where social comes into it. It allows us to inspire potential customers and, you know, the younger generation, which are going to be the future customers as well.
What about sort of brand safety issues? Because that's something that's been very sort of has dogged social platforms, especially after the past year, you know, with COVID misinformation and also sort of socio-political and civil unrest going on. Do you think that enough's being done to sort of assure brands that they are safe when advertising on social platforms?
Yeah, I think all the social platforms are trying to act responsibly from what I can see. You know, even TikTok, like, they've integrated with Moat and IAS and all the sort of third-party verification providers to make sure that, you know, they're doing their bit in the space. I know Facebook are, you know, working extensively to try and, you know, manage that process. In terms of misinformation, yeah, I mean, it's so easy, right? User-generated content is so hard to kind of monitor. It's exploding. There's so much of it. It's really difficult. But I think it's moving in the right direction. I think when kind of one of these tech partners becomes so big in scale, they'll naturally come under more focus. And I think, you know, we're starting to see some articles around sort of TikTok as an example. They've been pulled up on some of the kind of brand safety elements over the last kind of couple of months. I think there's more to be done in the space, but I do think that they are working with, you know, bodies in the industry to try and stamp out as much of it as possible.
Excellent. We'll move on in that case to the second part of the podcast, where we talk to you more, Paul, about what you're working on and what you're interested in at the moment. So fire away. What's going on in the world of Performix?
Oh, this is like my favorite part of the podcast, probably. I get to talk about my work week. I suppose like my week this week has been an interesting week. So on Monday, I was sort of telling Lindsay that, you know, I hosted one of our Starcom leadership meetings. So I represent Starcom from a performance level with that leadership team. And we're talking about issues like tackling diversity and inclusion, but also sustainability in media, and running some workshops with clients around, you know, what does that mean from a media perspective?
What does it mean?
Well, it's more than just like recycling and making sure that you're not using paper, but it's how do you act more responsibly as a media partner? We're talking about like building a carbon calculator and what goes into building a carbon calculator on every media plan. You know, what does it mean to a client like Eon, as an example, who are quite big on it, or AXA? Like, how do we work with brands to start to understand that and be more sustainable for the environment? So these are like broad kind of world issues, right, that we're talking about in the media industry. So that's really, really interesting. So That was really engaging on Monday. On Tuesday, I took the day off to look after my four-year-old, and I took her to a Tumble Tots class, which I'm not sure if you guys know what Tumble Tots is, but by name, it's quite obvious. And we were sat around in a circle with our shoes and socks off, singing like songs with a bunch of other parents. You can imagine me there, how out of place I felt, probably.
You must have hated every minute of that.
Oh God, it was only for 35 minutes, but it felt like 3 hours. And then like yesterday I was judging for the Performance Marketing Awards and looking at like all the great work that's going on in the industry. So that was really inspiring. And then today I'm with you guys. So yeah. Highlight of the week. Yeah, absolutely. So it's, you know, what's keeping me busy? Lots of different things. We've recently won quite a large automotive client as a group. And yeah, a lot of my time is going on making sure that we onboard that smoothly, kind of in the UK, make sure we find the right people to work on it, etc.
Excellent. And I mean, what on a more wide scale, what goings on in the industry are of particular interest to you? Are there any stories that you've been following particularly keenly or you're very interested to learn more about?
Yeah, I think like I'm following TikTok quite a lot, as you we've spoken about today. Yeah, I think they're just fascinating.
What that impression,
yeah. Just a fascinating business, really. And I'm just like, I'm trying to understand what their next move is, because they're moving so quickly. You know, clients are really excited and asking about what the next innovation is in the space. So I think there's that piece. There's trying to work out, you know, what a future without cookies looks like. That's a big exam question that we're working with brands on. One of our kind of clients, Ancestry.com, is, you know, a really exciting business that we're working with them in international markets on. So we're looking at that international kind of market expansion footprint. So I actually took, being sort of true to the brand, I bought a DNA kit recently, and that's also keeping me busy. And the results got analysed, so I'm sort of a proud Greek Cypriot, you know, like in nature. And the results came back.
Oh God!
They were fine, but they were surprising. So I was 60%. My heritage is 60% Greek Cypriot, 30% Middle Eastern. So that's like they don't break it up. 1% Eritrean / Ethiopian, and the rest kind of like Albanian, Grecian, and Turkish.
Wow. Which
which is brilliant. If you haven't taken one, I really advise you do. But that's also...
You're just pushing your brand there to get more sales. We get what you're doing.
Shameless plug.
Yeah, very good.
And go through the paid search ad, please.
Nice try.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've got like really great clients, really ambitious clients that we're working with, and that's keeping me busy and interested in work, really.
Excellent. Brilliant. Okay, well, that's about all we have time for this week. So thank you very much, Paul, for agreeing to come on and be my first non-Exchange Wire guest. Very much appreciated.
My pleasure. I hope I've done you justice and proud.
Very much so. Couldn't have asked for more. Thank you very much. And thank you, Lindsay, as always, for being an excellent head of content and an excellent podcast guest.
Thank you, Grace. And thank you, Paul.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, guys. Have a great day.
You too.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you, everyone, for listening.